home with our son and has given me strict instructions of what I'm allowed to share from my personal experience. More seriously, this is something of a significant personal issue for me. I don't come from a Christian family, and growing up, I would have approached questions around sex and sexuality in much the same way as many others in our culture would think about them. Like most teenage boys, pursuing sex and relationships was the norm for my friends and I growing up. I started to look into Christianity in my teenage years, and I read some stuff, and I became convinced that it was true. What I mean by that this man, Jesus Christ, who was teaching and ministering in a kind of outpost of the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago, was not just an influential teacher, but actually the Son of God. God in the flesh. God in human form. And so for me, what was interesting is that at that point, this whole question of sexual ethics was the biggest reason why I wasn't willing to become a Christian. I wasn't willing to change the way I lived to take account of the Christian teaching on this subject. A few years later, while studying at university, I had a significant change of heart. Through a series of events, I became a Christian, and my life was profoundly changed, including over time my perspective on sex and sexuality. And since then, I've spent much of the last 11 years grappling with this whole question, both for myself and now also for the church that I help to lead. Over the years, I've loved discussing this with my secular friends, really for two reasons. One is because this is the stuff that matters. We think about love, sex, and relationships. Probably, I think most of us would agree, whatever worldview we're coming from, that this is the stuff that causes some of the highest highs and the deepest woes of our lives. So this stuff matters. The second reason I like discussing it is just because I love engaging with really contrasting assumptions, different perspectives. When I talk to my friends, my colleagues in business, I found that people are coming from wildly different places on this subject, and I find it fascinating to try and come to a place of alignment on this question. So that's me. But why are we asking this question? Why is this question relevant to us? Well, I would argue that there is some real substance of truth behind the question. What I mean by that is Christians have been weird about sex. And I think you'll particularly appreciate this if you've grown up in a Christian family. I think for some, this weirdness manifests itself in a kind of unspoken prudishness, a kind of silence, like we just don't talk about sex in our house, that kind of thing. My wife, Jen, grew up in a church-going family, and sex was just something they didn't talk about. And what that does in someone as they're growing up is it kind of creates an unsaid sense that this is dirty, this is not for us. Sometimes people who grew up in kind of religious families of this nature will say the whole topic of sex has a kind of layers of shame and religious guilt and condemnation attached to it because of their kind of family background and their environment when they're growing up. For others, I think this weirdness manifests itself primarily in the distance between the Christian worldview and the kind of standard assumption of our culture. I think you can see this probably most prominently in the idea of virginity. The idea, this is certainly true when I was growing up, but I think it's true today, that the idea that you're a virgin is a significant source of embarrassment for most teenagers. And they seek to change that situation as quickly as possible. Witness pretty much every single coming of age, teenage, high school drama or film ever. Think American Pie, Inbetweeners, all those sorts of different shows basically have the same narrative of guys and girls seeking to lose their virginity in some way. And yet this is the calling for the Christian who's not married. And this is not a horrifying punishment from God. It's the Christian worldview would suggest this is actually a perfectly satisfying way of life. My friend Naomi, who's one of the writers for Salt, wrote an article, you can look it up, The Joy of Living Without Sex, where she articulated a very positive vision of the celibate life. She's a 30-something woman who's never been married and is choosing to live without sex until she is. It's not the life that she's chosen for herself, but one that most of the time she finds deeply satisfying. And yet for many secular folk, the idea of restricting yourself in this way, the idea of limiting your kind of sexual desires, or even confining sex to marriage to one person for all of your life, seems utterly unthinkable. I would actually go further and say, more than weird, there are a number of examples where the church has just been deeply unhelpful on this topic. You can think about hypocrisy, pastors who've preached one thing and then have been doing something else in their lives, and a kind of sense of absolute hypocrisy and double standards. You can think of bigotry. Think of churches and individuals who've used Christianity as a kind of a cover to justify their own bigotry and intolerance. Think about Fred Phelps and that kind of God hates fags movement that was very prominent at one point a few years ago. Or just a general sense that the church has been opposed to the LGBT community and LGBT rights. And probably most prominently, I think the greatest evil in this area is probably the idea of the prominence or the frequency of sexual abuse. That churches, and obviously the Catholic Church has been particularly prominent in the news in this area. Only recently was it George Pell, I think he might be the fourth most senior cleric in the Catholic Church at one point, was found guilty and sentenced earlier this year. And you think when you hear these headlines of this abuse, really what happens is the church loses any kind of moral authority to speak on this subject. And so in many ways, I think you'd be absolutely right to describe the way Christians have acted on this issue as both weird and at times deeply morally reprehensible. I think we can also see this pattern emerging at the kind of sociological, at the societal level. Over the past 50 or 60 years, we've gone through what commentators would describe as a sexual revolution. And as society has taken on a more progressive attitude to sex and relationships, that a gulf has emerged between the church and the rest of society. The church appears like a religious minority that's hanging on to an outdated and irrelevant sexual ethic. The mantra of this sexual revolution is the emphasis, the desire, the highest value is on freedom, the freedom to be able to sleep with who I want and when I want. And if personal freedom is considered one of our highest values in this age, the church is seen as one of those voices that is seeking to repress and constrain our freedom. And for many, the church feels old-fashioned, repressive, and intolerant. I think this is the primary reason why, or one of the primary reasons, why many Londoners would never consider the Christian faith. And what I mean by that is that I know many people who would describe themselves as having something of a spiritual itch, that they either they feel a deep sense of dissatisfaction with the standard secular narrative that says life is utterly meaningless. You know, one philosopher put it like this: how can it be that this world is the result, this is an atheist analytical philosopher, she said, how can it be that this world is the result of an accidental Big Bang? How could there be no design, no metaphysical purpose? How can it be that every life, beginning with my own, my husband's, my child's, and spreading outwards, is cosmically irrelevant? She describes herself as waking up in the night, feeling that sense of angst, existential angst. So there's some who feel a sense of existential angst. There'll be others who just say, I don't think it's possible to kind of collapse all of reality into just the material. There must be, you can't kind of explain human things like love or kind of all the different existential questions purely by looking at the material world. And that's, I think, why you see this interest in different things like mindfulness and meditation and yoga and all sorts of different things that come under the category of kind of spiritual but not religious. So I have many friends who have that kind of spiritual itch, but I know that for many of them, they won't look to the Christian faith as the answer to those spiritual questions or longings, because it feels to them like the Christian faith comes with it kind of like barnacles attached to a boat with a kind of moral framework that is repressive and constraining and limits their freedom. And actually, what's interesting is that I reflected on this, I've come to almost the opposite conclusion. I'm convinced that actually Christianity has a much more positive view of sex and sexuality that's become, certainly than the view that's become normal in our culture. And rather than being anti-sex, I want to show you that actually the Christian worldview has a very positive and high view of sex, which actually speaks to our deepest desires and longings. Actually, I'm convinced on this that when you see and understand the Christian worldview on this subject, actually you get a really key insight into what is the essence of the Christian faith. However, I don't think we should start there. The question we're answering to this evening, why are Christians so weird about sex, already assumes one key assumption. And that is that the Christian worldview is weird, and more than that, that the Christian worldview doesn't lead to human flourishing. And again, I want to suggest to you the precise opposite. Actually, our current attitudes and social mores around sexuality are not leading to human flourishing. The increased freedoms that we found ourselves, that we've embraced as part of this sexual revolution, have not quite led to the level of satisfaction that they promised, and actually have brought with them a whole series of unhelpful and unintended, perhaps, consequences. You don't have to be a Christian to recognize this. An increasing number of secular commentators are recognizing this fact, are recognizing in some way that the wheels are coming off the sexual revolution project. I think it's hard to spot this if you've grown up in this culture, because you kind of this is the soup that you swim in. So you just kind of take it for granted without really stepping back and saying, actually, is the way that we typically do sex and relationships in our culture really leading to human flourishing? And I would argue, actually, when you look at the way we're living right now, it isn't. And I would describe this almost, maybe this is a bit too far, but I would describe this as our present sexual crisis. In December last year, the journalist Kate Julian published an article in The Atlantic entitled "The Sex Recession: Why Young People Are Retreating from Intimacy and What This Means for Society." In it, she detailed that despite the kind of huge number of freedoms that we have in our society and our sex lives, actually the amount of sex and even the quality of our sex lives is diminishing. This is what she said. "These should be boom times for sex. The share of Americans who say sex between unmarried adults is not wrong at all is an all-time high. If hookups are your thing, Grindr and Tinder offer the prospect of casual sex within the hour. Sexting is, statistically speaking, normal. Polyamory is a household word. Shame-laden terms like perversion have given way to cheerful-sounding ones like kink." I don't think kink is that cheerful-sounding personally, but anyway. "Our culture has never been more tolerant of sex in just about every permutation. But despite all this, American teenagers and young adults are having less sex." And she goes through and tries to identify what are the different causes of this sex recession. And actually, you can see, by the way, that this phenomenon has been recorded in a number of other contexts. The Danish government started running adverts to try and encourage married or couples to have sex to increase their birth rate. The Japanese have got some horrifying statistics on this, like almost half of married couples haven't had sex in a month in Japan, and a similar percentage of 18 to 34-year-olds are virgins. Now, don't hear me the wrong way. I'm not saying you should go away from tonight judging your sex life by the quantity of sex that you're having. But I would argue this is at least the implicit assumption and goal of our culture. But so the author speculates on all different sorts of different drivers behind this sex recession, busy lives, economic pressures, anxiety. But she finds a number of kind of key drivers, key common threads. And the first driver that she mentioned was fascinating to me. It was pornography. The first reason that she gives is pornography. As the huge proliferation of pornography and masturbation rises, she argues that our sex lives are suffering. In many ways, I think pornography is something of a classic example of the sexual revolution. We thought it was harmless, so we dove, is that right, the past tense of dive? We dove into it, dived, sorry. Making up words here. We dived headlong into it. Try not to make a mental picture there. And we're starting to see the significant harmful consequences as a result. Before we even talk about the people trafficking, the ubiquitous female exploitation, the financial greed driving an absolute billion-dollar industry, we have numerous reports of porn diminishing our sexual appetites and actually even wrecking people's relationships as partners feel jealous or feel like they need to match up to a standard of beauty that is found in pornography. One letter in The Guardian from a young woman in February of this year was absolutely chilling when I read it on this subject. She said, "I recently used my boyfriend's phone and a porn video was open. His 45 searches were limited to teen and skinny and my confidence came crashing down. He has one very specific taste, and I am not skinny and nor a teen. I can't comprehend that I'm not sufficiently attractive to my partner at the age of 27. I can become skinny if I try, but I can't become a teen. My emotional reaction is as if he had been cheating. Why am I not enough, and how can I be enough? It takes me back to my first relationship when I was 18, and my then boyfriend stupidly talked freely about porn. My immediate thought was, I am not enough, and that this was the start of 3 years of serious anorexia and 2 years of bulimia. I thought he would stop watching other women when I was hot enough. Now I can't sleep at night. Why won't I feel good enough until he stops watching porn, which will never happen? I'd feel awful if he touches me, and I feel awful until I can get skinny, but I can never be a teenager. And actually, I think one of the unsaid things about the explosion of pornography actually is I think it is one of the key drivers of the body image crisis that we live in. The proliferation of sexual imagery around our culture puts a huge pressure on people to have bodies that then reflect the sexual imagery that they're seeing. I honestly think about it and think I would really rather not be a teenager growing up today. It's really common. You go onto the BBC News website, you can see loads of stories about how it is frequent that girls are almost expected to send nude images of themselves to boys, but to just as kind of as a way of starting a relationship or as part of their relationship, it's an expectation that they send a naked picture of themselves. Then that picture gets shared, and then just think of the shame and embarrassment that they experience when that happens. I think the BBC report I read today said 6,000 instances of underage sexting last year. Porn also affects the person consuming it. This is something that scientists are starting to tap into, that the brain starts to rewire itself. The brain releases dopamine when you're looking at pornography, and then as the brain kind of can't quite cope with that level of dopamine release, it gets overwhelmed by that chemical overload and shuts down part of the dopamine receptors, which means then that you need to be pursuing greater and greater, kind of more hardcore pornography. The porn view doesn't get the same high and needs to kind of just up and up the ante. It's a kind of law of diminishing returns. They end up kind of enslaved by it. In fact, this even reduces, it's been documented that it reduces people's desire for normal human physical relationships. The famous musician John Mayer said, "This is my problem now. Rather than meet somebody new, I'd rather go home and replay the amazing experience I've had. What that explains is that I'm more comfortable in my imagination than I am in actual human discovery." So we embraced our freedom without realizing the consequences. I think the other way we can see this, one of the other areas, you could go into lots, but one of them is the growth of no strings attached sex. And I think there's a number of different consequences for this that maybe we haven't quite realized or we're starting to realize. One is consent. I think part of the reason why our culture has grappled with this whole question of consent, which has kind of blown up recently, is because, and don't hear me wrongly, I'm not saying that in any way that there weren't people abusing others' consent in kind of standard relationships. But I'm saying that when you go into a hookup, kind of no strings attached relationship, sleeping with a stranger or someone you don't know very well, it puts you in an inherently vulnerable position. It's inherently difficult to navigate the social contract of exchanging your body with another person whilst you're drunk. That's not, as often is the case, that's not an easy situation to put yourself in. That's, I think, one of the reasons why we have so many consent issues at the moment. I think we also, no strings attached sex has turned people something into commodities. In September 2015, an article came out in Vanity Fair magazine entitled "Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse." And this article is absolutely kind of taken the internet by storm. If you Google it, it's a very popular article. The author had interviewed a number of different dating app users, but there's one quote that stuck out to me, and again, I've seen it quoted in other articles, and it said this. This is Dan, an investment banker, describing using one of the apps. He said, "It's like ordering Seamless," referring to the online food delivery service, "but you're ordering a person." Now, don't get wrong, I'm not a technophobe. I'm not saying apps are wrong and everything and anything like that. But I'm saying that the apps have kind of come at a unique moment in history when we've kind of typically conceived of human satisfaction through a kind of consumerist lens. And together, we have, together these things have kind of coagulated to create a perfect storm where it's almost like we've learned to our sexual relationships are kind of a commoditization of others, that it's very common for us to treat people like objects. And actually, in any other context, we'd find that kind of thing deeply unattractive. But for some reason, we kind of allow it, or that's become part of our sexual mores and our sexual behavior. It's been normalized. Well, I think finally, on the subject of our current sexuality, I think what's fascinating is our newfound freedom has not brought the satisfaction that it promised. Mark Regeneres, in his book, Cheap Sex, showed that numerous studies have shown that the least satisfied group in terms of sexual satisfaction in our culture are actually people not in a relationship, but kind of promiscuous singles, so to speak, that they're the least satisfied group in terms of sexual behavior. So I think that we've unshackled ourselves from traditional morality and become enslaved to our appetites, seeking ever more pleasure. One author described it as ever-increasing appetite for an ever-diminishing pleasure. So taken together, I'd argue that the sexual revolution has not delivered on its promises. But as we unpack our kind of contemporary sexual mores, we have to come back to, well, what is the Christian vision of sex? And I share this not because I want you to adopt the Christian sexual ethic without choosing to follow Christ, without becoming a Christian. I think that would be disastrous and probably impossible. I want to show you this vision of Christian sexuality because I believe that it most chimes with our deepest instincts and longings. In a sense, what I want to argue is that the Christian worldview of sex makes the most sense of life. It explains our deepest desires, and I think it has the greatest potential to lead to human flourishing. And the main idea, the very center of the Christian worldview on sex, is really that sex is powerful. Many people assume that the Christian worldview is anti-sex, that it's restrictive and opposed to sexual pleasure. Actually, it's precisely the opposite. That rather having a low view of sex, Christians have a high view of sex. In Paul's letter to the Corinthian church in the New Testament, he's instructing the church not to sleep with prostitutes. But the reason he gives is striking. He does so, he said, he who does so becomes one body with her. He's not just talking about physically there. He goes on to quote from the story of Adam and Eve to say, the two will become one flesh. In a sense, what he's speaking of this in this one flesh description is saying sex is more than a physical act. It's the joining of two people together, body and soul, the fusing of two into one. In a sense, he's kind of like the precursor. I mean, I don't want to say that the Spice Girls are kind of replacing Paul, but you know that line when they say, tonight is the night when two become one? That basically is what Paul's saying. that sex is the moment when two people are utterly united. It's the combining of body and soul in one person. It's the ultimate symbol of a lifelong commitment that two people are making for one to one another. Two separate individuals are united together for the rest of their lives, and sex is the ultimate expression of that new unity that they have together. It's much more than a physical act of personal satisfaction. It's the act of becoming totally vulnerable and giving yourself entirely to the other person. When you have sex with someone, you're saying to them, I completely belong, I belong exclusively to you, and you are completely mine. We are one. And of course, that's why it then accompanies this kind of promises, this commitment in all other areas of life. Now, if you have that, or if you can see that sex has the potential to have this kind of high vision, then actually you have a more Christian attitude towards sex than you realize. I think you can see the power for sex to unite two people together in all sorts of ways. I think you can see the way that sometimes people enter into no-strings-attached sex with the intention that they will not have any kind of relationship with this person, but then they have that phenomenon of catching feelings. See, that sense of where afterwards they end up romantically desiring the other person despite their best intentions. In fact, this even has kind of biological roots to it. Our bodies are wired this way. During sex, the body releases oxytocin, which is that same hormone that is released in the body of a nursing mother when she's breastfeeding her child, her baby. It's otherwise known as the attachment hormone, and it literally exists for the uniting of the mother to the baby. And that's the same hormone that is released in sexual intercourse, saying actually that this is biologically the kind of a driver of attachment together. The desire to attach the other person during sex is not just an emotional one, but a chemical one. This is why one advice columnist in Glamour magazine, not my personal habit of reading, but one I found quoted elsewhere, we often get prematurely attached. Even when you intend to have casual sex, biology trumps your intentions. Glamour magazine said it, guys. You have to believe it now. Actually, I think you can also see this in the way that your sexual experiences can linger on for years after you've had that experience, often accompanied maybe by a sense of regret. I think you can see this in the sense of jealousy that we have towards our partners, other sexual partners. If sex is meaningless, why should your partner's previous sexual encounters matter? I can think back to a time at university when my friend was saying to me, I know I shouldn't, but I am deeply jealous of my girlfriend's previous boyfriends. That I've no right to be jealous of them, but I am. I don't like the fact that I'm sharing her with them. And I think that kind of sense of jealousy is something that many people can relate to. Why? Because sex in and of itself is creating this powerful bond that is, in a sense, monogamous in its inherency, I would argue. Maybe in the Q&A some of you will want to disagree with me on that. I think if you have sex with someone, it's harder to walk away from the relationship without being hurt. We might try and deny it, but there's a greater sense of rejection than if you just date someone. Actually, that sex forms something of a union. And finally, I would argue this, you can see this in rape and sexual abuse. If sex is meaningless, why is rape so damaging? What is it about sex that has the power to change someone's life forever with one brief or momentary act? Why does someone feel so violated by that act? Why does it have the potential to make you feel so defiled, so dirty, and so used? It can't just be about consent. It must be that the sex in itself is a deep and weighty act. So if this is a deeply significant act with to unite two people with lasting consequences, I would argue that the only way that makes sense is the Christian worldview. Because this is not what you would assume from the secular worldview. From a secular perspective, what is sex? Sex is two lumps of matter being united together for the sake of procreation or enjoyment. It's not an inherently deep and meaningful act. I mean, perhaps a more popularization of the secular worldview might be that song from Bloodhound Gang when they sang, "You and me, baby, we're nothing but mammals. Let's do it like they do it on Discovery Channel." I heard that many times. I used to work for the Discovery Channel. People used to sing that to me very frequently. Not as an off invitation, just as I don't know why. it's the first thing that came into people's heads. But my point is, these guys, the Bloodhound Gang, have in many ways have kind of summarized our kind of the secular approach to sex. And they said that this is fundamentally a meaningless act. Let's just do it like animals. And we've taken them at their word. But actually, we've found that sex is more powerful than they suggested. I think some of you here may feel like victims at times, cast aside in the endless meat market of sexual relationships. Or you may be nursing a hurt from a previous sexual encounter, which you told yourself wouldn't matter and wouldn't have any meaning, but actually does. Or maybe you harbor pain and regrets where no relationship followed. And this is why Christians would argue that sex needs boundaries. Because sex is so powerful, it's such a unique way of uniting yourself with another, that's why boundaries need to exist. It's like saying to have casual sex is like a contradiction in terms. You're saying with your body, you are mine, I am yours, we are each other's forever, but with your life, you're saying the complete opposite. To take this powerful tool and take it out of the context of commitment will have a hugely damaging effect on people's lives. And you'll often end up hurting the other person. And actually, I think we do still, even today, recognize that sex needs to have boundaries. Think about incest, think about abuse, consent, like we spoke about. We recognize there is a need for boundaries. And actually, we recognize the need for boundaries in life. Think about the Olympic athlete who needs to run, get to the top of their sport, or if you want to get to the top of your career. You sometimes need to constrain your freedom for the sake of human flourishing. It's actually, we sometimes lose sight of that in our kind of narrative of freedom in our culture. So all of this comes together in a kind of beautiful picture of a couple giving themselves to each other for the rest of their lives, expressing their commitment to one another and their exclusive commitment by not sharing themselves with anyone else, not bringing any kind of illicit relationships into it, not bringing past relationships into it. And actually, this is actually the picture we get in Genesis, in where Adam and Eve are beholding each other, and it says, they are naked and unashamed. And you have this picture of two people looking on each other, ready to be united together without any other kind of temptations or influences. I think that is a beautiful picture. That is what I think we are all longing for. But actually, I would argue that sex is the gift that points to the ultimate gift. What I mean by this is if you consider the heights of what sex can be, giving yourself completely to another, being united together in love, I think you could be forgiven for thinking that this is the most transcendent experience that that life offers. And I think it speaks to that inherent human desire to be loved and to be known, to be completely loved and to be completely known. But actually, it's only half the picture. The Bible gives us a picture that marriage and sex within marriage is actually a picture of an even greater love union. I think the Christian faith is unique in saying that we worship a God who puts himself, who uses this picture of marriage and sex to say something about his character and his engagement with humanity. What it's saying is that marriage within the Christian worldview, the commitment, the exclusive commitment of the spouse for another, is a picture of God's love for his people. And so you've got to imagine this, the center, the very essence of the Christian story is the story of the person of Christ coming to earth on a rescue mission, on a reconciliation mission to be united with his people, which ultimately culminates with his death on the cross. And with that death, he takes the penalty that humanity deserves such that they might be reconciled to God, that they might be reunited to him and be in a union with him, be united with him. And what you've got to see is that that actually is a love mission. It's a mission of God wanting to be reunited with his people, a bit like a lover chasing his beloved, like wooing and calling his beloved into relationship. And this is the picture you see in a number of places in the Bible. What he's saying is that when you experience sexual union where you're completely loved and completely known, actually, this is in some way just a small glimpse into what it means to have a relationship with God. Because at the very center of the Christian faith is the idea that God wants that same union with you, wants to know you completely, he loves you completely, and desires that kind of same picture of exclusive commitment, of one giving oneself to God entirely as he gives himself for you, ultimately shown by his death on the cross on your behalf. So in a sense, what it's saying is sex is simply a foretaste, a glimpse of what it means to have union with God. And I guess I want to provocatively say that some of you need to see the reality behind the picture. I've got a nephew who loves model cars, absolutely adores model cars. He's 3 years old. If he gets to 25 and still only loves model cars and not real cars, you'd say there's something of a problem there. You say, like, you know, kind of need to grow up and see what real cars are like. In a sense, what I'm saying is, if you are one of these people who's not a Christian here today, but said, look, I think sex is, as you describe it, this powerful transcendent union, then I want to suggest to you that actually you've got something of a glimpse of what it means to have a relationship with God. But in doing so, I want to call you to that bigger picture and say, look, not just to focus on the model car, but actually come to the real thing. So where do we go from here then, if this is true? Well, first of which is, I expect some of you, I'm just working on the side of the room here, some of you may still be deeply offended by the Christian worldview on sex and relationships. And I want to say that's okay. In a sense, that's to be expected. Jesus offended many in his ministry. And the worst thing to do would be to walk away from him because he offends you. The last thing you want in life is a God who agrees with you on everything. Because if you have a God who agrees with you on everything, then really you have no God at all. Tim Keller, a pastor in New York, puts it like this. Now, what happens if you eliminate anything from the Bible or from your understanding of God that offends your sensibility and crosses your will? If you pick and choose what you want to believe and reject the rest, how will you ever have a God who can contradict you? You won't. You'll have a Stepford God, a God essentially of your own making, and not a God with whom you can have a relationship and a genuine interaction. Only if your God can say things that can outrage you and make you struggle, like in a real friendship or marriage, will you know that you have got hold of a real God and not a figment of your imagination. So an authoritative Bible is not the enemy of a personal relationship with God, it's the precondition for it. So actually you should expect at times to be offended and challenged by the teachings of Christ. If you're not, there's a danger that actually you're constructing a God in your own image. So how are we to respond? If you're offended here, how are you to respond? Well, I think it all hinges on his identity. See, either Jesus is a popular but reactionary and conservative teacher who had an influence at one time and continues to have an influence today, but is basically just a prominent teacher in the history of humankind. Or he is who he said he is, that he is God in the flesh. If he's an inspiring teacher, but you disagree with him, you can ignore him. But if he is who he said he is, that he is actually God in the flesh, then I don't think he leaves us with that option. He can't be ignored. His ideas can't be ignored, but he can't be ignored. You have to remember that the claims that Jesus Christ makes about himself are really quite incredible. If you were to draw a list of the top 10 people in all of history and identify just purely on a sociological basis, like who has had the most impact in all of human history, you'd undoubtedly put Jesus in the top 10, probably top 5, perhaps top 3, perhaps even the most influential person who ever lived. If on the other side you were to draw a list of people in the world who've claimed to be God, actually, I think Jesus would be the only name you'd recognize on that list. You've got to remember that all the major religious teachers of the world, Muhammad, Buddha, the Guru Nanak, all sorts of different religious teachers, did not claim divinity. Actually, when someone claims divinity, we usually laugh them out of the room. We usually suggest they might need to go and get mental health support. And actually, even if at times some people are in that list have a kind of accrued a following, after they die, their following has completely disappeared. Jesus is the only one on both lists as the most influential people who ever lived and the person who claimed to be God. And today, that claim is believed by millions, if not billions of people around the world. That claim in itself demands an explanation, demands an investigation. You have to say, well, how is it possible that Jesus is the only one on both lists? How is it possible that so many millions of people believe this seemingly ordinary man, this teacher in 2,000 years ago, was actually God in the flesh? And I think there's evidence to look into. There's a journey, an investigation to be done there. Sir Edward Clarke, a High Court judge, said this of the evidence. He said, as a lawyer, I've made a prolonged study of the evidence for the first Easter day, the resurrection. And he says, to me, the evidence is conclusive. And over again in the High Court, I've secured the verdict on evidence not nearly so compelling. He's saying, for him, he's convinced the evidence proves that Jesus was resurrected and he is who he said he is. Now, if that's the case, I think you have to take his teaching on this subject, but actually on all subjects, seriously. Actually, because with his claim to be God is a claim and a call for you to follow him, for you to be his disciple, for you to become a Christian. If you're interested in exploring the evidence for yourself, we've got some books for free on the table outside on the way out. Some of you are offended. I would suggest you need to look into this question of who is Jesus. Some of you would say, yeah, this sounds an attractive worldview, but if you look at my life, it's the absolute opposite of what you describe. Like in a sense of it feels, the Christian vision for sex and sexuality feels unobtainable. And I want to say absolutely it is unattainable if you're not living and walking as a Christian. But you've got to understand the very essence of the Christian faith is that there is an invitation for all people whose lives of all characters and shapes and sizes are invited into the family of God. I think about the woman caught in adultery in John's gospel. She's a sexual sinner. She's dragged before Jesus. The crowd want to stone her. But Jesus' words cut straight to the heart. He who is without sin cast the first stone. They all drop their stones. They know none of them is righteous. His words bring life and freedom to the woman. He says, neither do I condemn you. He said, look, no one else condemns you. Neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more. He has an invitation to this woman, a woman who's lived a sexually immoral life. His invitation is to her to come and enter into his family, enter into his people, and enter into that union, that love relationship that I described before. He's showing that this invitation is for all who recognize that lives are messed up. And in fact, the precondition for you responding to Jesus' invitation is a recognition that you need him, a recognition that your life does not match up to his standards. And there'll be some of you today who are drawn to Christ, just simply that say, yeah, this is an attractive worldview, but not more than that. Actually, I'm convinced that you are who you say you are. And all I would say is simply that the picture that the New Testament uses is it says Christ stands at the door and knocks. And he invites you to open the door and allow him to come in. Essentially, what I'm saying is that he's saying, look, I'm here ready for you if you want to receive me and respond. And if that's you, we'd love to chat to you afterwards. I realize tonight we've just absolutely scratched the surface on this stuff. I'm sure I've said stuff that might offend you or disagree with, but also stuff that we just haven't talked about at all. So I'm really looking forward to answering your questions. Thank you very much.